In the past decade, opioids have claimed nearly 11,000 lives in Illinois, and it has some doctors looking at marijuana as an alternative to treat pain.
Medical cannabis has been a game changer in my practice, and I have seen patients do well.
With Chicago area physician Dr. Leslie Mendoza-Temple. Plus, we continue our series of interviews with candidates for Attorney General. But first, the Senate has agreed on a spending plan and to hold an open debate on immigration next week. Senator Dick Durbin says it's time to pass a bill that addresses recipients of the DACA program.
I think there is mounting public sentiment across the United States among Democrats, Republicans, and Independents that we have to do something and do it now.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, the Senate agreed on a spending deal to avoid yet another government shutdown. The plan will increase both domestic and defense spending by roughly $300 billion over the next 2 years. It's according to some reports anyway. You might remember that last month, the federal government shut down because leaders in Washington couldn't agree on what to do about immigration, especially for the nearly 1.8 million people affected by the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Illinois, by the way, has the largest group of DACA recipients in the Midwest. And because President Trump rescinded the program started by President Obama, it will expire on March 5th. This time, the Senate plans to hold an open debate on this very topic next week, although they're already facing pushback from members of the House and activists who are alarmed that a deal on immigration wasn't reached before the budget vote. We'll be speaking with some of those activists later in the hour. But first, I spoke with the number two Democrat in the Senate, Illinois' Dick Durbin, earlier this morning about the budget deal in immigration. There's a lot in this budget package. So I started by asking him what stands out for us here in Illinois.
Well, there's so many things. And to keep our community centers, clinics open, just absolutely essential for thousands of people in Illinois. The Children's Health Insurance Program, which we recently extended, depends on these clinics to deliver the services. So first step, let's make sure that basic health care is available for everyone who lives in our state, and that's what this bill does. Secondly, I have a special affection for the provision that increases medical research. I decided a few years ago when I was running for re-election, there were a few things I wanted to get done, and one of them was to do everything I could to increase our investment in medical research at the National Institutes of Health. This will be the third straight year, that we've given a 5% real growth increase in medical research, and I'll tell you, it's going to make a difference. These young researchers who now have confidence that they're going to be funded in the future are sticking with research instead of giving up on it. And that means that a lot of things, breakthroughs that we are desperate to find, are likely to occur.
I wanted to ask you about immigration. You've said all along that a vote for recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, needs to take place. That's scheduled in the Senate. Is that scheduled for next week?
It is. What we have is a promise from Senator McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, that we will bring to the floor for debate the issue of immigration and DACA. It sounds pretty routine to the listener, I'm sure, but it's a breakthrough. It's been over a year and a half since we've had an actual debate on the floor of the Senate. I mean a real one. Democrats and Republicans offering their best amendments and debate on the floor. You think that's normal in the Senate? It hasn't been for a year and a half. It's been 5 years since we've taken up the issue of immigration. And so this, to me, is a step forward. We have a looming deadline of March 5th, which President Trump created. As of March 5th, every single day, 1,000 young people protected by DACA, which was President Obama's program, 1,000 young people will lose their protection. They'll be subject to deportation. They'll no longer be able to work legally in America. This looming deadline means that our debate is timely and important.
Just in regard to DACA, obviously you've been working very hard on a bipartisan solution for this. Do you feel like you have the support, bipartisan support, in the Senate to pass something with DACA?
Oh, I think we're so close. I just this morning talked to one of my colleagues who's part of what we call the Moderates Caucus. And I really think if anything has emerged from this debate that has long-lasting impact, it's the fact that the strong center in both the Democratic and Republican caucuses are now sitting down together. There are about 25 of them, and they are trying to get the Senate back to its history, its tradition of open bipartisan debate. They're trying to tackle issues which we have skirted around and avoided, and this is one of them. So I think there is a possibility, and I underline possibility, that we can put together a bipartisan coalition in the Senate to solve this problem. I desperately hope that the Speaker of the House will give the same opportunity to his members to debate this issue before March 5th.
Yesterday, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi spoke on the floor for 8 hours in support of DACA. She also said that a large number of House Democrats would vote no on this spending bill unless Speaker Ryan promises a vote on this issue. Do you agree with her on that?
I went over to the floor of the House yesterday when I heard what Nancy was doing. She's a close friend and one of my strongest allies in dealing with Dreamers. And I went over there and saw her standing, and she was there for over 8 hours, broke a House record, and for the record did it in high heels, and stood there and delivered, I thought, the most impassioned plea you could imagine by telling the stories of these young people and how they'll be affected. All she's asking for is a debate on the floor of the House of Representatives and a vote on, you know, competing proposals. Let's see if we can come up with a bipartisan group that helps to solve the problem in the House. And that was her message yesterday. So I hope Speaker Ryan, who came to Chicago to the City Club with Congressman Gutierrez several years ago and said he supports the DREAM Act, will show it. All he has to do is say, fine, we'll schedule it. We'll have the debate. Let's see how it ends. That's the right thing to do.
Are you confident that you've been talking about how you've been developing, going back to this strong center in the Senate? Do you think that exists in the House? Do you think that there's that? Do you think that there's enough people in the House to have something pass?
I do. I do believe, based on the Republican members of the House who've stepped forward, have either listed their own names as co-sponsors of measures to solve the problem or signed up with coalitions that have endorsed this, there are more than enough votes to pass this on a bipartisan basis. The House, unfortunately, is shackled by what is known as the Hastert Rule, which refers to former Speaker Denny Hastert, who said, I won't call a measure for consideration in the House unless a majority of the majority members, majority of the Republicans, support it. Well, I don't know whether a majority support this among the Republican caucus, but I will tell you that I know there's a majority, a bipartisan majority, to pass it. And it comes a time, Speaker Boehner realized this, I hope Speaker Ryan realizes this, where the good of the country and the importance of the issue demand that you step up and consider a bipartisan solution.
And so what are you thinking now about President Trump? And if you can get some, if something is passed in the House, something's passed in the Senate, passed in the House, whether this is something he will sign?
I have no idea. He changes his position on this by the hour, certainly by the day, by the tweet. One day he is heaping praise on these young people who, through no fault of their own, have no future in the United States. The next day, he's talking about getting tough on immigration. On one day, he's talking about the fact that we have a lot of immigrants who make America better. The next day, he's endorsing an immigration measure, which takes us back to some horrible days in American history, when in 1924, we passed an Exclusionary Act, which decided that we would allow immigrants to this country from certain parts of the world, but not from others. It was entirely discriminatory against Jews and Italians and Asians and Eastern Europeans, and for 41 years it was the law of the land. What President Trump has proposed is to go back to the same immigration, I should say the reduction in legal immigration, that we saw in the 1920s.
I wonder, Senator, about people who are listening who maybe agree with President Trump or say, look, it doesn't matter. Why did you all hold up a budget for this? Even if these people were brought here through no fault of their own, their parents didn't bring them here legally and they should just get in line like everybody else.
Well, of course, they'd love to get in line, but under our current laws, they cannot get in line. If you were brought here at the age of two, it's not likely that you had much say in the decision by your family. But that decision now is going to determine your future and your life and whether you'll have any role in America. Overwhelmingly, 80% of Americans believe that the fair and just thing to do is to give these young people a chance to earn their way to legalization and citizenship. It isn't by just sticking around. They have to show with their lives, by their work record, by their education, by their the fact that they have not committed any serious crimes, that they are worthy of being part of America's future. They're ready to do it. They're ready to fight for it. And to say to them, we don't need you, we don't want you, we educated you, you've lived here, you can leave now, would lose an important part of our future. They are talented, they're ambitious, they are part of America. It's the only country they've ever known.
You mentioned that the House, the Senate will be taking up a debate on immigration and DACA. I wanted to ask you about undocumented immigrants apart from DACA. Those recipients, maybe if we look at the numbers, are roughly maybe one out of every five undocumented immigrants in the country. What about the other 8 million or so people who are here?
5 years ago, I sat down with a group of senators, four Democrats, four Republicans. We spent 6 months. We had a lot of give and take, a lot of arguments. At the end of 6 months, we produced a comprehensive immigration reform bill. We took it to committee. We faced hundreds of amendments in the Judiciary Committee. We reported out to the floor of the Senate, and we passed it. I believe 68 senators, Democrats and Republicans, voted for comprehensive immigration reform to address not only the Dreamers, but everyone across the board to fix this broken immigration system once and for all. We invested more money in border security than had ever been invested at any point in our history. We were serious about it, and we sent the bill to the House of Representatives, and they killed it. They refused to even consider it, to bring it up for a vote, or even debate it in a committee. And so 5 years later, here we are empty-handed. I'm for comprehensive immigration reform. The president's decision to kill the DACA program and put a deadline of March 5th of this year on it has created a crisis that we have to address immediately. But I hope after we've done that, we move quickly to comprehensive reform.
One quick question for you, Senator. We're going to hear from Fred Sow with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights right after this. I wonder what your message is to him and other immigration activists who are nervous that Congress won't take action.
Well, I share their concern. I'm just as nervous. We do have a path in the Senate to debate and pass a measure, but if we pass it, it could have the same fate as comprehensive immigration reform. If Speaker Ryan will accede to the request of the Democrats and allow this to be debated on the floor, we can get it done before the President Trump deadline of March 5th, which he created. If not, we're going to be stuck again. But I think there is mounting public sentiment across the United States among Democrats, Republicans, and Independents that we have to do something and do it now. And I think the Dreamers have led this because of the issue of fairness and justice, which is part of their debate. But I think other Americans are stepping up. I can't get over how many groups. I want to salute Cardinal Supich here in the Archdiocese of Chicago, the Jewish leaders across our community, those in Protestant churches who are speaking up, the business leaders. Many of them are lifelong Republicans who are speaking up. We have a coalition that is growing in size and intensity. So I'd say to your next guest, don't give up hope. We are going to push this forward. America is on our side.
Senator Dick Durbin, thanks for your time.
Great to be with you.
And Fred Sow, as I mentioned, is with us now. He's a senior policy counsel with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Hi, Fred. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla. Good to be with you.
Fred, as you just heard Senator Durbin say, he's nervous about everything, particularly in regards to DACA and action for deferred action for childhood arrivals. How are you feeling about folks in Washington right now?
Well, we are just as nervous and anxious about what has been happening in Washington, D.C., despite our best efforts and despite all of the organizing, the trips to D.C. that we and many of our allies have taken over the past several months, and unfortunately, the lack of results and the lack of action. You know, we are deeply disappointed that Congress still seems to be stuck on this issue, and you know, for that matter, we believe that the Democrats could have driven a harder bargain. We are looking forward to Leader McConnell keeping his promise of moving legislation, or at least bringing legislation to the Senate floor. We were skeptical of that arrangement when it was announced a few weeks ago in the wake of the federal government shutdown. But I think it's incumbent on Senator Durbin and our other allies in Congress to hold Leader McConnell to his promise and to make sure that the end result is a good one, and then to make sure that the Speaker Ryan on the House side also takes up this legislation.
And I guess that's my question, Fred, about what you all are doing in terms of the House side, folks like the different member organizations within the Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights throughout Illinois. What kind of action are you all planning in terms of the House?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have been meeting with our allies, with various members of the Illinois House delegation, to make sure that they are still emboldened to move forward with the DREAM Act, or with similar legislation that moves out of the Senate. We had been running a phone bank over the last several weeks to reach out to legislators and make sure that they are hearing from their constituents. Weekend after next, we are holding our annual immigration summit, where we will continue to highlight this issue and again call upon our Illinois delegation to hold firm and insist on a version of the DREAM Act that does not come at the cost of the really harmful provisions that that seem to be.
Fred, let me stop you there, because we're going to have to take a break, but we'll continue this conversation on the other side of the 21st.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, presenting a public history exhibit in the north-south corridor of the University of Illinois Main Library throughout the month of February, with highlights from a century in publishing and design. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. My guest is Fred Soe. He's a senior policy counsel with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, on the line from Chicago. Fred, it was just before the break, you were talking about different action, phone bank, things like that you all are doing in terms of mobilization for Washington. I wanted to ask you about what you all are doing on the state and local level. I know that yesterday you all joined a couple of other folks in plans to act on the state and local level. What's your thinking there in terms of what you all are doing throughout Illinois?
Well, certainly while Congress remains gridlocked, we have to pursue policies that protect immigrants and keep immigrant families together wherever the opportunities may arise. And fortunately, we've been able to win a significant victory on the state level with passage of the Illinois Trust Act. We may have other opportunities on the state level to pass other legislation this spring. We've been working with President Cullerton on a number of ideas that may be able to move forward in the coming session. We've also been working on the local level, with leaders in various communities to enact ordinances or resolutions that declare those communities as welcoming communities, that distance themselves from immigration enforcement on the government level, and kind of more generally, acknowledge and respect the contributions of immigrants to those communities.
Fred, you mentioned in terms of local places. I know that Urbana and Chicago are two cities where the mayors have been very outspoken about being sanctuary towns. Where else are you all working or talking to?
folks? Mm-hmm.
Well, we have worked in Oak Park, in Evanston, in Berwyn, in several other communities, and the language that we've developed has also been adopted in a couple of Indiana communities as well. We have been working with leaders in a number of other places in central Illinois, particularly Bloomington, we're hoping that we can work out language that suits the circumstances in those communities as well.
Fred, last question for you. Obviously, the major focus of this immigration debate that's taken up the most attention over the past couple of weeks has been Dreamers or those young people affected by the DACA program. As you heard from our conversation with Senator Durbin, that's a small fraction of the undocumented immigrant population across the U.S. What kind of comprehensive immigration reform are you hopeful of any of that happening in this year?
Well, Senator Durbin pointed out the difficulties that members of Congress have had with the White House. As I was starting to say before the break, the White House has come up with its own platform that we believe will negatively impact immigrant communities and our entire country. Certainly what the White House has come up with is a non-starter for us. I believe Senator Durbin has even said it's a non-starter for him. I think given the current climate and the current composition of the federal government, we may unfortunately be playing defense, except with respect to DACA recipients, and that lends urgency, not just the local and state level advocacy work, but also the electoral work that we're planning for later in the year.
That's Fred Soe with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, where he's a senior policy counsel with the organization. Fred, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla. Take care.
More and more, we're hearing about the devastating effects of opioid abuse. Here in Illinois, deaths due to heroin have almost doubled, while deaths from prescription opioid overdoses have quadrupled since 2013, according to the state's public health department. We've heard lots of politicians talking about this campaign season, about what they'd like to do with treating pain. Well, some lawmakers and physicians are pointing to marijuana as a possible alternative. And Christine Herman has been reporting on this for Illinois Public Media and Side Effects. We'll tweet her story out. That's just out, by the way, if you follow our handle at 21STShow. Christine, of course, you might remember that name as a former 21st producer. So now she's a reporter, and she's here with me in our Urbana studios. Hi, Christine. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
So, Christine, you spoke with a lot of people who are dealing with pain that would normally be treated with opioids. But I think it's probably important for us to start off by talking about what kind of pain are we talking about? When we talk about chronic pain or severe pain or crippling pain, that's the kind of pain that we're talking about here in terms of what people are thinking, looking to marijuana as a possible solution as opposed to opioids.
Yeah, that's right. These are people who have serious injuries or illnesses that might end up leaving them in pain that lasts for weeks or even for months or years. It keeps them from being able to just function normally, to keep their job or to take care of their kids. And many of these people and many patients who I've talked to, both for this story and prior reporting I've done, they're trying all different sorts of therapies and treatments and, medications to see if anything can help. Many times with the treatment of pain, you're not able to find something that actually solves the problem completely. It never exactly goes away, but you might learn how to cope or function.
And so one of the people that you, a good example of this was one of the gentlemen in your story, his from Springfield. His name is Larry Lankart. Can you tell us more about him?
Yeah, Larry, he's a Springfield resident. He, back in 2001, he said he was otherwise just a very healthy person, but he just woke up in the middle of the night one night and was in really bad pain. He thought maybe it was a bad flu. The next day, he goes to the ER and finds out he has this condition called diverticulitis. It's basically an infection in his intestines that required four major abdominal surgeries over the span of many months. So it was a very excruciating process that he went through. And this is kind of what he described what his life was like.
In the beginning, it was like life wasn't worth living. And I think I forgot what it was like to not be in pain. When you're in your 40s, that's way too young to be thinking about death every day. And, you know, I never attempted suicide or anything, but believe me, I thought about it.
Yeah, so it's hard to hear him talk about, you know, what it's like living with that kind of pain.
Yeah, it's like an example of what you're, this is what we're talking about when we're saying chronic pain or severe pain.
Yeah, it can be this bad. And he said the hardest part was he was put on multiple prescription opioids, and he was just always keeping his eye on the clock because he's feeling the pain and wondering when he can take his next dose. But the levels of prescriptions kept going up, and he was on really high doses. And last summer, he wanted to get off of them, so he worked with his primary care doctor to taper off the opioids.
I took my full dose for, you know, 4 weeks, and then I took one less for 3 weeks, and then I took, you know, one more less for 2 weeks, and then basically down to zero.
That's Larry Lankert. He spoke with reporter Christine Herman, who's in studio with us now. So, Christine, he was taking Vicodin and OxyContin, and that was how he was able to wean himself off of this.
Right, but in order to help him with that, he said he started smoking marijuana every night, and that was able to help him cope with the pain. And he said he would even forget to take his last dose of meds at the end of the day, and that was very unusual for him to forget about taking the next dose.
And so medical marijuana, is that something that was available to him? Like, would he have been a candidate for this?
Yeah, so pain is not on the list of qualifying conditions in Illinois. In Illinois, you need a doctor to certify that you have one of 40 qualifying conditions. So just chronic pain in and of itself wouldn't have qualified him, but he did get a separate diagnosis of fibromyalgia in 2014, and so he should have been able to get it at that point. But he couldn't find a doctor anywhere in Springfield who would certify him, and when he spoke with a medical cannabis outreach person in Illinois, these are people who help patients navigate the process of applying for a card, he was told the closest doctor was several hours' drive away. So other people who I've also spoke to have shared their experiences with me. They talk about many challenges when it comes to getting access to medical marijuana in Illinois. It costs a lot of money to be able to apply, and once you get the card, to be able to purchase the cannabis because insurance doesn't cover it. Many of these doctors that are willing to sign these the forms that say, yes, this patient has a qualifying condition, they have very long waiting lists because there aren't that many of them in Illinois, and then you have to wait several months.
And most of them are in the Chicago area, too.
Many of them are, but there are in other pockets of the state. But according to Larry, he said he tried and he couldn't find someone in Springfield.
And so we've had Don Herman's actually, State Senator Don Herman has been on the 21st talking about this. He actually introduced a bill that might make this easier, right?
Yeah. It's called the Alternatives to Opioids Act. And so I mentioned in Illinois, pain is not a qualifying condition. But what Senator Harmon's bill would do is any patient who gets a prescription for opioids, they would be able to then apply for a medical marijuana card. And they would go through an expedited process without the background check and fingerprinting that you have to go through otherwise. So instead of taking the normal 2 to 3 months, it would take 14 days. And the idea, he explains it here.
The ravages of opioids and the subsequent use by many people of heroin is killing scores and scores of people across our communities. No one has ever died from an overdose of cannabis. It's not a gateway drug, it's an exit drug. This will help people get off of opioids or heroin or something worse.
Yeah, so that's Senator Don Harmon, state senator. He says when I spoke with him that he hopes to move this bill through the legislature early in the spring session, which began last week.
So I want to ask you about the medical side of this, Christine, because he says no one's ever died from an overdose of cannabis and that it's not a gateway drug, it's an exit drug. What are doctors saying about this?
The truth is, it's probably not a black and white issue. It might be helpful for some patients for treating their pain. And then for other people out there, it could lead to addiction and to serious addiction and possibly even to taking other prescription drugs developing a drug use disorder. So it's a really tricky question to talk about the research because there are a lot of studies out there on medical marijuana, but not the kinds of clinical trials that you have with FDA-approved drugs.
Right. So is part of the problem, I guess, because it's not like with a drug like Vicodin or OxyContin, those are produced by pharmaceutical companies that would then have trials. that marijuana hasn't really that. Is that why there's hasn't
yeah,
been as
that,
many studies?
Yeah, that hasn't happened. It hasn't gone through that process. And the reason is because, according to the federal government, marijuana is classified as a Schedule I drug. It's in the same category as heroin and LSD. And Schedule I means, the definition is, it has no medical use. It's highly addictive, prone to abuse. So that makes it really hard to study. So those types of, the gold standard for research studies is what's called randomized controlled trials, where they have different sub, you know, groups, and they test the drug and then they compare it to a control group. Those types of studies don't exist on marijuana. It's very hard to get funding and approval to do them, especially in humans. But with that said, there are many smaller scale studies, and in aggregate, if you look at what they're showing, and they're showing similar trends, you can't just write them off completely. So a really good resource is the National Academy of Sciences. In 2017, they did this extensive review of the literature, and they found that there's strong evidence that cannabis is effective for a handful of conditions, and one of them is chronic pain. And that is the most common reason that people seek marijuana.
Right. And so it sounds like when you're reporting, you found doctors who fall on both sides of this issue.
Yeah. So I spoke with Aaron Weiner. He's the director of addiction services at Linden Oaks Behavioral Health and Edward Elmhurst Health. This is in the Chicago suburbs. He opposes the use of marijuana as medicine in this current system. But even he said that there's no debate that marijuana is helpful for pain. But, you know, the striking thing is it's not on Illinois' list, even though it's the one of a handful of conditions that actually has a good amount of evidence behind it. The question of how the conditions on Illinois' list, how they got there, that's a whole separate issue. But this is one that's actually backed by the most evidence, and it's not on the list. Last month, there was a Cook County judge ordered the state's health department to add intractable pain. This is pain that is not treatable with other therapies. To add that to the list. But that moves on hold because the department is appealing that ruling. I reached out to the Department of Public Health. They declined to comment on pending litigation.
So Dr. Weiner is someone who says there's no debate that marijuana is helpful for pain. Is this something that he supports, though?
He told me he would like to be able to see patients who could benefit from marijuana, be able to get it. But his primary concern is that the policy right now in Illinois and in other states, the policy is getting ahead of the science. So you heard Senator Harmon refer to marijuana as an exit drug. And it's true that for some people, it may be able to help them get off drugs like you heard from Larry, and it might help them treat their pain. But Weiner believes, based on other studies, that marijuana is a gateway drug. And there is some evidence that suggests that the more that people who use marijuana, that after a period of years, they may go on to develop a prescription pill problem later. And so he's concerned about that, as well as links between marijuana and ER visits. He would like to be able to see patients in pain get relief, but he thinks our current system has too many problems.
So as we're thinking about that, you talk to doctors on both sides of this issue, right? He was like, he's kind of on the fence. I know you had other doctors that you spoke to who feel like this is something that is that they do want to prescribe. I want to go back to Larry Linkert, because you started with just sort of talking about him and how much medical marijuana played a role in his life. Can you tell us how he's doing now?
Yeah, shortly after weaning off of Vicodin, as he described, he got diagnosed with cancer, and he was able to get a medical marijuana card certified by his oncologist, and he was just kind of frustrated that it took so long for him to get access.
It took me, you know, basically a death sentence before I could have a chance of getting a marijuana card. I tried for 16 years with chronic pain and with fibromyalgia, and I could not get a physician to okay it, you know, because I think Chicago area and Rockford area and Quad Cities and even Marion and down south, there's doctors that will qualify you. Springfield is kind of locked up tight. Not one. And I've been to many, many, many doctors.
So, Christina, it sort of seems like this boils down to there's a lot of confusion still about this issue, a lot of debate about it. And that's kind of where we're at right now.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
There's more about this. Christine Herman's story is with Side Effects. We will tweet out a link to that. We'll have it at our website at 21stshow.org. Thanks, Christine.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All week, we've been playing interviews with candidates for Illinois Attorney General. They're all vying for current Attorney General Lisa Madigan's job. 10 folks, in fact, 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans who are hoping to replace her. The primary is on March 20th. In some cases, early voting has already started. Here's how we did this. Like a job interview, we tried to ask each candidate almost the same questions, and we recorded all of the conversations ahead of time. Today, Sharon Fairley is a former federal prosecutor, former general counsel of Chicago's Office of Inspector General, and most recently, the former chief administrator of Chicago's Independent Police Review Authority. That's the agency responsible for investigating police shootings or misconduct claims. She oversaw the creation of the Civilian Office of Police Accountability that was created in the wake of the Chicago police shooting that killed 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, and she lives on Chicago's Southwest Side. Sharon Fairley, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So you announced your intention to run for Attorney General just a few weeks after COPA, the Civilian Office for Police Accountability, was formally opened.
Yes.
Why did you want to leave that job to run for Attorney General?
So, well, the first thing I want to make clear is that those decisions were completely separate, although the timing coincided. So I had actually decided that it was time for me to pass the baton to a new person to lead the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, because I wanted to make sure that everything about the agency was new going forward, so that it wouldn't have the tie of me having been appointed back in the wake of the Laquan McDonald shooting. I really started to feel that people were really questioning whether the agency really was truly going to be able to fulfill its mission and be a new entity if I was still at the helm. So I made that decision way before Attorney General Madigan decided not to run. And then after that, I decided to enter the race. So they were two completely different decisions. So then, you know, Attorney General Madigan did announce that she wasn't going to run. And I started to think about the importance of that office, because the attorneys general, those positions have become so increasingly important, not only for the citizens in the states that they serve, but also as a coalition nationally. And I really started thinking about the fact that we really need a strong and independent person in that role. And I decided to step up to the plate to do it myself.
As you mentioned that coalition, we've certainly seen Lisa Madigan join other attorneys general in suing the Trump administration. Do you think that part of the role of attorney general is to take on the federal government if needed?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the Democratic attorneys general have formed a really strong coalition and are really serving as that first line of defense against the racist and regressive policies of the Trump administration. And it looks like that's a role that they're going to have to continue to play throughout this presidency. We have to be vigilant and make sure that these almost daily assaults on our civil rights and our health and well-being by the Trump administration, we have someone who's going to stand up and protect us against them. And we just need someone with the courage and the tenacity, but also the legal prowess to stand up to these attacks and prevail. And so these jobs are really increasingly important.
That said, what do you see as the main role of the attorney general?
So the attorney general is really the top lawyer in the state and is really meant to represent the state and its citizens in all legal matters, and to be an advocate to make sure that the citizens of our state have the opportunity to pursue their lives in the state of Illinois, with economic prosperity, with clean air and water, and being safe in their homes and having their financial well-being protected from abusive and exploitative practices of businesses and or government. So it's a multifaceted role, but it's a really exciting one.
And for you, what would be your most important priorities should you be elected?
So, of course, for me, I believe that the most important thing is to protect the citizens from exploitive business and government practices. But there are definitely a couple of areas of focus that I would pursue a little bit differently than has been done in the past. So the first and foremost is government integrity and transparency. We have some issues here in Illinois with lack of integrity and transparency in the way that our political leaders are operating. And certainly that became very, very clear this past fall when we all learned about the egregious sexual misconduct that's going on down in Springfield, and the fact that there has been no legislative inspector general in place to take complaints about that misconduct. I mean, I found that the fact that that position remained unfilled for 3 years unconscionable. And it's because our political leaders don't have the political will to want to hold themselves accountable. And so we need an attorney general that will not allow that to happen and that will really work to improve integrity and transparency in government at all levels within the state. And so that's something that I plan on spending a lot of time and energy on. The other big area of focus for me is obviously I have come from the justice system and a lot of time in the criminal justice system. And I believe that we still have a lot of work to do. And of course, having spent the last 2 years working on police reform and police accountability, that's going to be an essential part of the Attorney General's mission for the next, you know, probably 10 years, because this process of reforming the Chicago Police Department, that's a very, very long-term project. So I have a lot of experience in that area, and I'm really looking forward to having a personal role to play in that.
And when you think about criminal justice reform, what would be your priorities as an attorney general?
So there's several components to it, but I would say the top are obviously dealing with over-incarceration. The second thing would be dealing with bail reform and other court costs. So these are the aspects of the criminal justice system that just exacerbate the cycle of poverty amongst the communities of color that interact with the criminal justice system. But then, of course, just public safety in general, to me, is a part of that. And, you know, the challenges we face here in Chicago, they're not just in Chicago. When it comes to the trust between law enforcement and the communities that they serve, those are issues that exist across the state, the challenges we exist across the state. And so my goal is to really develop and play a much more strategic and proactive role working with law enforcement to rebuild trust and to work on smart, effective crime fighting programs so that we all believe that we can be safe on the streets of our cities and in our homes. And that's a really big, important role that I think the Attorney General can be more proactive in.
Now, there's a crowded field of seven others that are running for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General. Why should voters choose you?
Oh, by far, I'm the most qualified for the job. So, everything that I've done in my personal and my professional life has really prepared me for this. And I have this really unique set of professional experiences and personal characteristics that I think voters are telling me are really, really important in this job. First and foremost, I'm going to point to my independence. I will have gotten to this job by my own perseverance and hard work without the support of the political elite, and that's really important, because the Attorney General does have an important role to play in holding our political leaders accountable. And for candidates in this race who have taken hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign funding from the people that they are intended to be kind of keeping an eye on, I think that that's really problematic from an independence perspective. And I believe that I showed in my work for the city that I can do my job in an effective and fair way, but in an independent way, calling the balls and strikes as I see them and making headway and getting things done. So independence is really a big personal characteristic that I think is important. But when you also look at the professional experiences that I've had, I've had this unique combination of business experience, so I know how to manage people, manage processes, and manage budgets. But I have also had the complex litigation experience and experience in the criminal justice system. But more than that, experience more broadly in lawyering in criminal, civil, and administrative settings. And so, for example, there are other federal prosecutors in this race, but their legal experience is really limited to that, whereas I have a much broader range of legal experiences to draw from. And this is really important because the role of the Attorney General involves all different kinds of law, and it's a very complex set of responsibilities. Then you need someone who has that kind of well-rounded experience. And, you know, there are other people in the race that are lawyers, but they just don't have really that kind of complex litigation experience or the investigative experience that's necessary to do the job well. So I have the complete package. And so that's why I entered the race. I do believe I'm the most qualified. And I think a lot of people are finding that's true.
Sharon Fairley is a former federal prosecutor, former general counsel of Chicago's Office of Inspector General, and most recently with the Civilian Office of Police Accountability. She is one of eight candidates running for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
For those who think there's no money to support local news, there's a movement in Chicago over the past few days that would surprise you. It has to do with the replacement for DNA Info Chicago. That site, which existed for more than a decade, had focused on hyper-local or neighborhood digital news in Chicago and a few other cities around the country until it was abruptly shut down last fall by billionaire owner Joe Ricketts. 3 months later, the former editors and reporters of the Chicago team are launching their own nonprofit news service. They started by asking for $25,000 on Kickstarter. Jen Sabella, Seamus Tooney, and Stephanie Lule, veterans of DNA Info, will serve as editors, and a number of former staff will come aboard the new Block Club Chicago. And how that Kickstarter campaign's going? Well, they're almost to $120,000. Seamus Tooney, the former managing editor at DNA Info and new editor-in-chief of Block Club Chicago, is on the line with us. Hey, Seamus, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So did you expect, you asked for $25,000 and you're up to almost $120,000?
No. I mean, we're blown away, to be honest with you. You know, we had an idea in mind of where it might go. We tried to set it at a reasonable level. But the fact that we hit the 25,000 within a couple hours of it going up Tuesday morning, just it really blew us away. Some of the reporters who are working for us said they were literally crying at their desks watching it go up. And I was stunned. I mean, like I said, we hoped it would do well, but never in our wildest dreams did we think it would be at 120,000 after, you know, 2.5 days.
So what is this Block Club Chicago going to look like? Is it going to be, how different will it be from DNA Info?
The idea is to make it as similar as possible to DNA Info. We really think we are onto something there, and we really had a great following. Just by covering the news in people's neighborhoods that other people weren't doing, whether it was just the goofy, quirky story or important stuff, you know, we would go to when developers would pitch a meeting before a neighborhood group, we would go to that, you know, tell people what was going up on their block, you know, much well before it ever landed at the city council level. We would do, you know, crime stories and try to put a human face on them. We would, you know, like I said, we would do, you know, goofy stories as well. I mean, you know, about the public park and the West Loop that they had to cancel the movies in the park because, you know, people didn't clean up the dog poop. So anything and everything that we found interesting, we had the reporters write, and usually the reporters found that stuff so on their own. So, you know, we hope to mirror that in many ways with our coverage. We are going to start out smaller than we finished at DNA Info, just a fact of life. We had a pretty large staff at DNA when we closed. And we're trying to make this sustainable. So we're trying to be realistic at first. We've got 3 editors, 5 reporters, and a bunch of freelancers who are going to help out. And we're going to spread them out, you know, around the city and do our best to bring in readers. And then we'll go from there. But we want to, we don't want to build it out so fast that it collapses, because we'd hate for it to go away yet again.
Yeah. And so you guys are going to have a subscription service. I know rates will start at about $5 per month. Seamus, we just have about a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you really quickly about the video on the Kickstarter site in which you have people in Chicago saying what they want from a new site like Block Club. What have you learned?
You know, what people really want is they want to find out, you know, this sounds, you know, obvious, but they want to find out what's going on in their neighborhood. And they're just not getting that in a lot of places. It's really hard to do this local level journalism without, you know, putting boots on the ground. I mean, you got to go to these meetings. You got to meet these people. And that's hard to do for some of these bigger outlets to really commit to a small story. But we're local enough when we're small enough that we can get out and go to those things. So, I mean, that's what we're hearing, that, you know, a voice to the voiceless was something that Jamal Cole.
Yeah, it sounds like, and you're getting a lot of, as we said, lots of people donating. I want to thank Seamus Toomey for being with us. Thanks, Seamus.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks for everyone who donated.
Yeah, that's Block Club Chicago. That does it for us today as well. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a good day.